makes
well,
me
libraries
feel
are actually
better.
Going the way of eliminating the fines now.
Yes, so is ours, actually, in Baltimore. That's true. Yeah, but, you know, I'd never minded paying them. You know, it's just, it's invaluable, the service that they provide. I'm a huge library fan and a fan of this movie, and I want to get to, it's interesting to me how so many of your previous films intersect with this.
That's right.
Obviously, the Breakfast Club connection is a fun connection from one library to another. But tell us a little bit about the genesis of this and how it intersected with your other another project.
Sure. So this was supposed to be the follow-up to my film Bobby. I was looking for another film to dig into, another story to dig into. On April 1st, 2007. The LA Times arrived at the house. I opened it up. There was an article written by a retiring Salt Lake City librarian named Chip Ward. And Chip's essay was about how libraries had become de facto homeless shelters and how librarians had become first responders and essentially de facto social workers. And so I was really moved by the piece. And he said, look, this is not just something that's happening in Salt Lake City. This is an epidemic. And so because I had done a lot of the research for Bobby down at the downtown branch Central Library in LAPL, I went back, I dug in, and started to just observe to see if it was, in fact, as critical as Chip Ward was talking about, and of course it was. So I began to think about, okay, on a particularly cold night, what would happen if the patrons decided to lock themselves in? How would law enforcement react? How would the media spin it? And how would politicians use this opportunity for their own gain? And again, this was 12 years ago before we, unfortunately, the movie is way more relevant now than it would have been had we made it in 2008.
And you know, it intersects too with your family's history with social action and nonviolent protest. I mean, so many of the cardinal, and I think one movie that we didn't mention earlier in the introduction was one of my favorites of yours called The Way. I hope people here saw it. It's just, it means a lot to many people. But this has, I think, a spiritual element. It just feels like so many of the cardinal themes of your life and your art are converging on this.
Well, I really, you know, and again, the story evolved over these 12 years. Initially, the first draft of the script was very dark. Had a very diabolical ending, and as the times changed, I kind of evolved with the piece. And many of you know, my father's been arrested 66, 68 times, depending on who you ask. All actions, nonviolent civil disobedience actions, whether it was for anti-nuclear or for immigration issues or homelessness issues. So thank God we've solved all of those. But so as a boy, as a younger man, I would watch him get arrested. It was oftentimes on television, the nightly news. Sometimes it would hit the national news. And I you know, would sit there watching it with my mom, and he'd often be reciting the Lord's Prayer as he was taken away in cuffs and loaded into a paddy wagon. And I thought, man, this is not good. I don't get this. I understood it fundamentally, but I didn't understand it spiritually until I started really digging in to the public. And so the film is a reflection of that. I owe a debt of gratitude to my father for serving as an example of what nonviolent civil disobedience looks like. Because when you look at all the great changes that have been made over the centuries, it has been in a nonviolent way.
True, exactly. And I think it's interesting the media portrayal in this, because I think one crucial element to nonviolent protest was the media. I mean, a lot of it was in order to create images that would galvanize people, which they did. That was the beauty of that movement. But images and narratives, and that was essential to closing that loop. And now we can't depend on that anymore. You know, that isn't necessarily a reliable stool, leg of that stool.
No, and you know, Michael K. Williams, the last line he has, last line of the movie really, is they're never gonna forget about us. And we have to make sure that we don't.
Yeah.
So how do we do that? How do we get there?
So I'm fascinated. We are going to be bringing out some stakeholders in the issues that are addressed in this movie, and we'll get into more of the content. But I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about the creative process.
Sure.
Because when you're starting with ideas like this and a theme and an issue, you make it, you know, your work as an artist is to humanize it and come from character. So just tell us a little bit about creating the script and the creative process of...
Well, when you look at libraries, libraries are really the where all of the issues of our time are intersecting. Yeah. So the intersectionality of whether it's climate crisis or opioid addiction or mental health issues, homelessness, violation and dismantling of our civil rights, constitutional rights, militarization of police, it's all happening under the roof of your local library. And so it just spending time there, just spending time being a quiet observer, it was impossible not to pick up all of the elements ultimately that you see portrayed in the movie. And part of my process, first of all, was spending time in libraries and trying to do it undercover. As best as I could. Initially, this movie was
supposed to... You didn't start dancing, too?
No, there was no dancing.
On the bookcase.
No, I'd put a hoodie up, and yeah, I would just right. quietly
Sorry,
observe.
Sorry, I had to ask.
I think, you know, again, it's that fine line between being a researcher and being a vulture, because there were people who shared a lot of stories, a lot of personal stories. Some of them were very heartbreaking. Some of them were hilarious. And so, again, it was that fine line of, okay, what do you include? Are you breaking a confidence here? And again, it was full disclosure. Here's what I'm doing. I'm here researching. But we did it initially. We were supposed to shoot in Los Angeles at the downtown branch. And so I was trying to convince the then head librarian, city librarian, to allow us to shoot there. And I said, look, we will not impinge on the public's right to access this information. I understand that the core tenets of the library, but when is the next time a movie about the library is going to be made? And I was begging her for 2 hours. I was begging the city librarian, and she was like shaking her head. I was like, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So I was like, why? Just give me one good reason. She said, well, we had a film crew in here several months ago. They turned on their lights. They got overheated. The sprinklers went on. A bunch of books were ruined. Oh. And I said, man, what a bunch of amateurs. Who was that company? And she said, it was a show called The West Wing. So I was just like, okay. So okay, I guess I'm going to Ohio. Thank you very much. Thank you. And we did.
And thank goodness.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Yeah. That's a beautiful library.
It is. It is. And Ohio is terrific.
And you have a special connection to this. Also brings in another piece of your
I do. My mom
life.
Was born in Cincinnati. My dad's from Dayton. They didn't meet in Ohio. They met in New York years later. But yeah, Ohio feels very familiar to me. It feels like home. And the state offers an amazing tax incentive to shoot there. They essentially, Ohio became a partner of ours in assembling the film, assembling the funding.
And so... So you assemble that, you know, you and I'm glad you mentioned the time that you spent in the libraries, because I think that you are, you have to come correct when you do a project like this in terms of representing people, you know, representing communities, representing disenfranchised communities. That's communities right. that are usually, I think, stereotyped or misunderstood. And so did you do a lot of relational work in order to just make sure that you had
I did. And it was being given certain access at Central, downtown Central Branch of LAPL for so many years while this thing sort of floundered in trying to get ready. One thing I learned, obviously, was about the sacred space that exists between the desk reference librarian and the patron. It is as sacred as doctor, patient, and lawyer, client. And I didn't understand that until I really started hanging out at the reference desk and was asked to step back oftentimes
wow.
by the desk reference librarians who just said, hey, you know, this is a private space and you're not entitled to be here mm-hmm. and listening to what this request is.
Wow.
So again, I had to respect that space. I had to step back. We took the film to ALA convention in New Orleans last June. I took it to Midwinter convention in Seattle in January. And of course, screening for librarians, I knew that if we didn't stick the landing there, we were doomed. And so, again, stood in the back of the theater and sweated it out. The reactions were great. The first question during the Q&A was, how did you get us so right?
Mm.
Which I felt relieved about. The second question was that a stunt double for you at the end?
So did he get it right? Let's get it. Yeah. Again, a tough room. And not shy, we figure. You're librarians, no, you're crazy people.
They are crazy.
You guys are wild.
They are, librarians are crazy, and they are not silent.
Love you.
No,
yeah, because
they
have
do
to be
not
quiet
stay
all
silent.
Day.
They are not quiet. They are.
And thank goodness for that.
Indeed.
The cast is extraordinary.
Thank you.
It's just so many names, and then the gentleman who plays Jackson, Michael
K. Williams, yeah.
Not necessarily a household name,
no,
but what a performance.
Well, Omar from The Wire and Boardwalk Empire and The Night Of, and
right.
But you're right, he's on the move.
But
he's
a showcase for him,
yeah.
and a great ensemble. So tell us about assembling that. I mean, how does that, does that kind of happen brick by brick and you get one and then
it
the other?
It does. You know, it started with Alec.
Mm-hmm.
Once Alec committed, it was all of a sudden the movie starts to look very real. We were, the advantage of independent movies and the disadvantages, you have a very short time period to shoot your film. So we shot this film in 22 days,
wow,
which meant that I had to shoot the movie in my head and on paper in terms of being really well prepped. So it's a call to Alec saying, I need you for 5 days. It's a call to Jeffrey Wright, I need you for 4 days. Gabrielle Union, I need you for 6 days. So to get short commitments from those actors who are obviously very, very busy proved to be the best way to call this and put this all together. It was then on me and my editor, Richard Chu, who you know from, he won the Oscar for the first Star Wars. He cut Risky Business. He cut The Conversation, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It was up to Richard and I, and really leaned into Richard about how to make it look like everybody was there at the same time. That was the feat, and I don't think we really miss a beat. I don't think we ever get a sense that no one is not there when, in fact, they weren't.
Oh, yeah, could have fooled me. Amazing. And the music, tell us a little bit about the music.
So there are three original tracks in the film. They're written by Che Reinfest-Smith, who also plays Big George.
Okay.
Big George,
yeah,
he's a miracle. Che, you'd know from, he was the third writer on the song Glory, was written by John Legend and Common, which won the Oscar. He was part of he was actually featured in a documentary called In My Father's House, which was about searching for his dad, who had been on the street for 30 years. He was homeless, and they were estranged. He finally tracked his father down, and the only place his father wanted to meet him was in the library. So that's where he felt comfortable. That's where he didn't want to meet at the shelter. He didn't want to meet anywhere else but the library. So they made this documentary. My mother saw it, and she said, hey, I think you really need to check this out, this documentary in my father's house. I think if there's a role for Che, you should check it. You should really consider it. Now, my mom calls me every day with some advice. And 90% of it, it's like, yes, Mom, yeah, yes, yeah, absolutely. But I wrote his name down, and for the next 2 weeks, I said, you know what, she's onto something, saw the documentary, called him up, and said, how do you feel about acting? And he jumped in.
And then he wrote those beautiful songs.
That's right. He wrote Weaponized. He wrote the end title song is Make Noise,
mm-hmm,
and then the third song is the version of I Can See Clear, mm-hmm, which that song wasn't supposed to be the end song, by the way. It was supposed to be Journey, Don't Stop Believing.
Oh.
And 2 weeks before we were supposed to begin shooting, I got this letter saying, you do not have the rights to use this.
Oh.
And I said, okay. I said, how do I appeal to Steve and to Neil from Journey? They said, write him a letter. So I did. 2-page impassioned letter. Hey, man, you know, I'd really, this is about what you guys are about, and on and on, and it's about social justice, and denied. So I thought, okay, we'll figure this out. So I was at a friend of mine's house in Cincinnati, and he had Spotify or Pandora playing. And the song came up, I Can See Clear, the Johnny Nash version. I thought, this is it. We just got the rights, though, I think yesterday or the day before. I wasn't going to chance it. We just sort of jumped in. We did it. And then we worried about how we were going to get the rights later. And Johnny Nash Co., they're headquartered in Houston. And, of course, they had the big hurricane that really put them out, wiped out their offices. So it was very difficult to get in touch with them for months. But I had faith. And And it, I think it proved to be a better song than Don't Stop Believing, frankly.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, I can't see it any other way.
No.
It's funny when you hear about these contingencies and these weird little twists of fate.
And some people have said, well, isn't it great? You know, Big George gets the glasses and it's really connected to I Can See Clear. I was like, no, that's not, no, that's like, that's just a really happy accident.
Isn't that weird?
Right? And they're like, but they want to read the symbolism into
sure.
it. And it's like, it doesn't exist.
Absolutely, just, yeah. Absolutely. Well, we won't tell anybody, no. will we? No, it was always part of the plan.
No.
So, you know, looking back on your career, Emilio, you have been in this business, you know, for a
careful,
while.
Careful, careful.
Manga, you know, because we're about the same. So, for a minute, blink of an eye.
35 years.
Well,
this, yeah.
And my question is about making a movie like this in this industry, the way it's configured now. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, but most of the movies being made now are comic book movies and superhero. You know, it's very there's a mid-range kind of movie that you really came of age in that they almost
That's
don't
right.
make anymore.
That's right.
So can you just sort of like, I mean, but you keep doing it and.
Yeah, I haven't learned my lesson yet.
Well, thank goodness for that.
About 20 years ago, I took a left turn. I stopped making the Mighty Ducks movies, and they were great, and they inspired kids to skate, and they were terrific. They served a purpose, but I stopped doing the studio movies. Before that, it was like two for them, one for me, that kind of ratio. But then I stopped doing any for them, and it was all for me. Mm. And that comes with an enormous price. The first picture of that detour was The War at Home.
Yeah.
We shot it in Austin. It was about a Vietnam vet suffering from PTSD. Not a perfect movie, but it was for me. It was important to sort of step out of sort of the mainstream and do something that I knew was going to nourish me. We followed it up with Bobby, mm-hmm. and then The Way, and now of course The Public. So I am, I'm really drawn to stories about people. I don't know how to make a movie that takes place in outer space or a superhero movie. I know how to make movies about people. And I know that is, you know. Thank you. And not that those movies aren't about people, but they're about other things and that I just don't relate to. So I make movies that I want to go see. I don't necessarily make art house movies,
mm-hmm.
But I make movies that I feel are artfully done and that play more mainstream but aren't really mainstream movies.
Right.
So it is, to your point, it's a really tough place to be in, and yet it's wildly fulfilling. Not financially.
Mind you. Well, but I mean, I do think... You know, these movies do have an audience. I think we're the audience, right? I mean, you know, it's just connecting this with the right. And I want to circle back to that maybe
sure.
a little bit later. Maybe it's a good time to bring out our oh,
but
go
no,
ahead.
I was just going to say to your point. So The Way, which you brought up,
yes.
and thank you. The Way has gone on now. It was released in 2011 here in the States. We did a very similar tour to what I'm doing now. We got on a bus. Begged my dad to get on a bus.
I was on that bus. I
right.
took a little leg of that.
And we did
27
cities over 50 days. And the film had this slow burn.
Yeah.
But then years after, it continued. And people all over the world, tens of thousands of people, have gotten off their couch and gone to walk 500 miles across Spain.
That's
now,
right.
I may never be able to do a movie that inspires people to do that sort of action again, but... You know, the New York Times did a piece talking about the Spanish economy, and they cited The Way as being partially responsible for the uptick in the Spanish economy. So, again, you know, movies, when they do their job,
That's right.
can do their job, and they can move, touch, and inspire people to step outside of their comfort zone and do something extraordinary. And so my hope with this is that, again, people discover it, they are inspired by it, and that they ultimately, when they see an individual experiencing homelessness, that they are able to park their bias at the door. Because I think oftentimes we assign a story to an individual that is not true. It's the story we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel better about that individual on the street. And so I think we need to stop that. Homelessness is a it's not a condition, it's a situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've got to treat it like that.
All right, well said.
But to your point, I know we're going to bring some folks out here. I want to stay in my lane because I'm a filmmaker first. I'm not an LCSW. I'm not a librarian. Play one in the movie, but I'm a storyteller first, and there are people who are experts in the field who know a hell of a lot more about this than I do.
Right. Well, I'd love to bring them out now if it's a good time. Could we bring our guests out? Are they ready to? Can they? Oh, good. Oh, they're. Hello. Hello, David. Very nice to meet you.
Hello.
Hello, welcome to our, could you all, I don't want to mangle and just read, so would you mind introducing yourselves, please? And I'm going to start with Cindy on the far right here.
Good evening. My name is Cindy Richardson, and oh my God, I'm from here, so yeah. And I am honored to work at a peer support recovery center on our own. I've been there for close to 10 years, and I also have the honor of contracting with our local CSB Region 10, where this is where my passion comes with homeless. I work as a PATH coordinator, a partnership for assistance transition for homelessness, you know. But, and I, and when I leave here tonight, I will be going to a place where I go twice a week. And I'm gonna say, if you leave here and you are going to a homeless shelter, give yourself a hand. Stand up, guys, because those are my guys right there.
I'm Herb Dickerson.
Hello.
Most know me in the community as a outreach worker for the Haven, the homeless shelter, directly a block away. And I do, if you want to know what I do what Emilio did. If you saw the film, I do exactly what he do 365 days a year.
Thank you for your service.
Well, my name is David Plunkett, and I'm the director of the Jefferson Madison Regional Library System in and around Charlottesville, Albemarle, Green, Nelson, and Louisa, and I'm assuming that I'm here to shush all the librarians.
No, don't shush them. We love them. Well, can I start with each of you, having seen this and having a little bit of a chance to process it, what resonated with, I mean...
I'll start. I think when Emilio was having a conversation with one of the gentlemen, and everything went through my head. You know, when I was asked to come here, I had all these ideas about spouting stats, data, and what it is. But the movie, I could not convey it any stronger than what that movie just did. It is Charlottesville. It is what we do. And so it is definitely peer, one-to-one. When you walk through a door, we're all the same. And if I can get everyone in here to realize that we are all the same, and I hope that resonated loudly from that movie, all you have to do is sit and speak with someone. I got the honor of speaking with the gentleman last week. Well, I really didn't know. He'd come in and he'd sit down, and then you get to know the inside of someone. So that's what resonates with me. I get the chance to work with other service providers to make this thing called homeless rare, brief, hopefully non-reoccurring, and we work hard at it. It's a lot of service providers going around trying to do the same thing, but. That's what that movie resonated. That's what that movie meant to me. It is what we see every day when we go to work, when we walk down the street, And, hey, Cindy, can I get a ride? Yeah, come on, let's go. You know, it's community.
Beautiful.
It actually scared me. And I said it because I'm sitting there, and I'm saying, this can't be right. I'm thinking Emilio don't have someone follow me around. I'm dead serious. I was in tears. Sitting right over there, I said, this can't be that exact. The only difference being, he was in the library, and I'm in the homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. It was almost exact. I said, they trying to trick me. And I wanted, people always ask me, won't you write a book about your life? I've been in a homeless situation myself, substance abuse about 30-some years. April 21st, next month, I'll be celebrating 17 years of sobriety.
Woo! Amen. Yeah. Yeah. Amen.
Yeah. But my everyday life, it's exactly what you depicted on that film. I mean, it's a little deeper than that. And they got to see it for a couple of hours. Mm. But just imagine doing that every single day with the same people. It's mind-blowing. I thank God for it was a little humor. I actually had to get up and leave. It was so real. I said, they trying to trick me into. I was sitting right over there thinking to myself, why are they doing this to me this way? I'm thinking you playing my life story. And then when I saw the coin, that blew me away.
All right.
Because I have a few of them.
Beautiful.
So I know what it takes to get those.
Beautiful.
And then try to convey that with the folks you're working with, I guess the homeless folks, which some are mental, some substance abuse, some both of the above, all of the above, prostitutes, I mean everything. It's just unreal to be sitting here with you.
Thank you.
Doing something like that.
Thank you. Thank
That's
you.
Your life work. Anybody that want to know anything about me, he just showed you me.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to ask no questions.
Well, I think I would echo what Cindy was saying is that, you know, yet the reality of the fact that it's about individual relationships, really. It's not about a class of people or a group of people. It's about the person who's right in front of you at the library, especially, you know, who comes up to the desk with that question. And then the other thing that really struck me was how, as you said a minute ago, how well you kind of hit on the professional ethos of being a librarian. And I think a couple of the speeches from Mr. Goodson and Mr. Anderson really kind of summed up why so many people have gotten into public librarianship.
David, you know, I think most of us who are library patrons know that, like so many of our law enforcement community, librarians are first responders. You know, they are often called on to be social workers. They're called on to provide referral services, perhaps. But are librarians now being trained in those skills?
Well, it was funny in the movie, and at the end of the first day when they were leaving, you could hear over the loudspeaker that there was Narcan training.
That's right.
Up.
Oh, yeah. I didn't hear that.
So that's a pretty widespread thing that librarians are being trained in that type of first response there. I know that a lot of library systems are actually working with service providers, and there are social workers on staff at a lot of larger libraries. This, I think, in Los Angeles, actually.
That's right. I think San Francisco actually started that model.
I think
it's now
right,
being
yeah.
duplicated across the country. And it's very effective. Mm-hmm.
So I think that the training is out there, and you know, it's been a long time since I got my library training, and things have changed a lot. But I think now, when you go through a program, you probably are trained in how to handle situations as a first responder there.
And for Cindy and Herb, I mean, is the library a place for you to convene your communities of interest and affiliation? I mean, do you go there in order to help people? You know.
Well, normally
clients.
For me, I go there if they call me to get some of my guests out of there that's overweight in hell.
Mm-hmm. Right, you're the guy.
That, you know.
Call Herb.
And that happens a lot. where I work is complete. We don't where I work.
Right.
So all the noise that you don't hear in the library, I get to hear. So I send you out. Go to the library. So I know you got to be quiet there, right? But I mean, it's totally odds, but we serve the same population.
Yeah.
Same population. Yeah. So, but they're human just like we are.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Some of them had some bad luck. And like I said, some have mental issues or substance abuse issues that's not being addressed or they don't want to address. Mm-hmm. But we still have to serve them regardless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, I mean, who would ever think my life would turn around? You know, so I'm going to live an example that it can't happen. Mm-hmm. But you just got to find the right person, the right individual, like the guy he played, to be caring and loving, and you to somebody that trusts and want to make change in their life.
Right.
And it's just one individual at a time. I mean, it ain't gonna work for the whole population, but you can change one at a time.
Yeah. For me, the library proves to be really instrumental in finding folks.
Yeah.
You know, it is a central location. It is where when it's inclement weather outside, I know where I can go. If I need to check on someone for Social Security, give them a ride to get their stamps, whatever they need, over to Region 10. So it's a second hub,
right.
You can kind of say. And so that's what I use it for.
And how, you know, I don't think it was not what the library was ever designed to do, but now it has become this de facto safe space.
Right.
And a symbolic space that you address. It's that last bastion of democracy. So there's like a point of, I think there's a pride in that and of seeing people, of really seeing these individuals as individuals. But on the other hand, it's not what you're necessarily there. I mean, how do you kind of navigate that? Like that's, yes.
Yeah, I like to speak on that. When I talked about the Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition, where a lot of the homelessness, where a lot of service providers come and try to make this thing a homeless thing, brief and non-reoccurring, there are a lot of librarians that are on that, out of this room of 20, 25 people, all there to try to handle and combat the same issue. And to hear what they bring to the table, of course, enhances what we do, and it's a reciprocal thing back and forth. So it's very, very important to have that relationship.
Right.
And that's what it boils down to. All of us having some sort of relationship with one another.
And I think we're very lucky in this community to have the Haven and the Downtown Library so close to each other.
Yeah.
And I know somebody said that Tom Shadyac is here who...
Yeah.
Where is Tom?
Tom!
Where is Tom?
Who is maybe primarily responsible for that, but I know a lot of those conversations about coming up with a day center, a place where somebody can go and take a shower or wash their clothes or have an address to get to or have a locker, started at the Central Library. I also know that a retired librarian, Jim Barnes, is here, who is very crucial in those conversations. So we've been talking about this for a long, long time. And when it comes to the role of the library and the librarian in this, it really is as Cindy said, you know, an individual, because the people who are coming into the library looking for information, it really doesn't matter to the librarian. I know there is maybe a little bit of pride in helping everybody, mm-hmm. but the questions that get asked from all walks of life are varied, and you get, you know, people are looking for information, they're looking for jobs, they're looking for, you know, some information literacy, some health literacy, things like that, and that'll come from somebody who's coming from the day shelter, or it will come from somebody who's been using the library as a community member for many years.
Right,
and libraries too are also great spaces for young people to connect not only with each other, but I know the Cincinnati Public Library has what's called a makerspace, sure. Which are often you often see in other libraries across the country where you've got 3D printing. There's a green screen for those who are interested in making films. There's a recording studio where young artists can go in and record. All that's for free. And so we forget that the other services that the library... I just got my passport renewed at the Cincinnati Library last year. So again, all the services that the library provides, we tend to forget about and we tend to take for granted. Eric Kleinenberg has a new book called Palaces for the People. And what he talks about is that the library is the cornerstone of what he's coined social infrastructure. And that we have to build on top of the social infrastructure that exists We need to keep donating to libraries and creating green.
Thank you.
And a lot, oftentimes, you know, people just believe, well, libraries are well funded, but it starts with law enforcement, fire, parks and rec, and then libraries are somewhere down here. So again, occupy your library, donate to your library.
And use your library.
And use it.
Go. We have time for one more, and I want to circle back to the film. And we were talking about these unusual release structures that you need to kind of, accommodate for this. So tell us a little bit about the journey of this film going forward and when people can find it in theaters.
So we open nationally on April 5th, from L.A. to New York and all parts in between. I'm in the middle of a cross-country tour, not by bus this time. It's I'm flying, and a little bit of driving. But so it'll be about 30 cities by the time we land in New York. What we've done is essentially a lot of grassroots screenings, film festivals, libraries, homeless advocacy groups, basically banging the drum and getting word of mouth screenings going. When we land in New York, we're going to do a bunch of more mainstream, the Today Show and Kelly and Ryan, then I'm going on Rachel Ray. I don't know why, but I'm going to go on. I'm going to cook something with her, I'm sure. But the grassroots stuff is the movement that we're creating now with the film is going to be sort of topped off with more mainstream. But if you like the film, if it resonates with you, if you make well, I need you. I need you to make noise. I mean, you know, Tom, you're no stranger to this. You know, with your film, I Am, was a brilliant film. You had to get out and sell it. It was just like The Way. It was the same sort of, you know, you have to get out and do these special screenings and bang your own drum for the movies that may be harder to connect. But once you get people into the theaters, they do connect with it. It's just, you know, again, convincing the studios that this is a movie that's going to play for human beings and land with audiences. They don't often see it until they see it. So here we go, April 5, and whatever you can do to make some noise on behalf of this film, it will go a long way.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, Emilio.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you
so much. Thank you.